Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina home, Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. Cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at Gridiron Greats Magazine. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Lund. He hails Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Spurs, Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Yes, yes. Happy to be here, Captain. Good morning to you.
I should rephrase that. Welcome to the show this morning because of our scheduling today and our special guest coming up. We're doing for you, a very, very early morning show. For me, a mid-morning show. So this should be interesting. But in any event, good to be back. In the football world, there's so much going on in the NFL. It's not even funny. I don't know where this money's coming from, but it is.
Oh, my God.
And I just do not understand what's going on. It is not the game I once. Not even funny. It's not even funny right now. But what I don't understand, what is going on in Cleveland? I guess Baker's gone. I don't know. I mean, what's going on with that?
Wow, Deshaun Watson last night signed with the Browns, and I had no idea there was any angst in Cleveland with Baker. I mean, you take all of his the commercials he does, you know, for you know, like Allstate Insurance protecting my home, man.
I don't get it. I really don't get it. I don't know what's going on. Are they converting him, or is he going to be the highest paid backup quarterback in history, or?
$230 million, Deshaun Watson, and the Seahawks obviously shipped, you know, as we mentioned last year or last week, Russell Wilson, you know, to Denver. So there's their quarterback. I heard they were making a run at Deshaun Watson, but about 2 days ago he said firmly no Seattle, but Cleveland. Think about that. 3 years ago they almost went winless, and now they're where people want to go. Jeez.
And I really don't get it. And I'm really wondering if it's going to be the premier backup if anything happens to. But again, I could be completely wrong. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's the same thing with Adams going to the Raiders. I had heard, you know, privately through my connection, saying he apparently has some sort of business interest. I don't know necessarily in Nevada or the West, but they made him the offer. He took it. In a way, it's a good thing for the Packers because they are loading up on the draft picks, which maybe they can, you know, trade off to get somebody Rodgers can throw at this year to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But I don't, in a way I get it, in a way I don't get it. And like I said publicly before, the NFL is a business today, pure and simple. Loyalty does not. There's no such thing as loyalty, one way or the other.
Yeah.
It's
what you said. I mean, it's becoming more and more. It's always been a business. All you have to do is think about, you know, Bill Walsh. I go back to this. Bill Walsh cutting Joe Montana, arguably one of the greatest quarterbacks ever, up until we saw Tom Brady, brought four rings, you know, to San Francisco. At some point, Bill Walsh cut him. That's a business. And Montana played another, what, 3 years in Kansas City? That's a business decision.
Yep.
A couple years later, Bill Walsh cut Jerry Rice, without a doubt the greatest receiver in NFL history, cut Jerry Rice, and he went on to play for the Raiders and then obviously retired in Seattle where he had great love for the Seahawks. I always think of Jerry Rice as a Seahawk. I forget what team he played for. Anyways, but I mean, you know, we've got Joe Namath as a Ram. We've got John Unitas, as a Charger. I mean, Franco Harris is a Seahawk. It's always been a business. I don't know what it is. Is it now all of a sudden front and center on us? I mean, or is it more prevalent now than it was in the past?
Well, I think it's more prevalent, number one, because the amount of money being thrown at everybody there under the disguise of calling it a salary cap, which I don't see how you can even say it's a salary cap because it's all loopholes everywhere for it. So it's just a plain business. It's basically, you know, you look at retail, Target versus Walmart. That's basically you got 32 Targets and 32 Walmarts going at each other. That's what it comes down to. So it's crazy. Very unsettling. Adams bothered me initially, but then afterwards, I looked at it a little more rationally, and I just said, hey, this is a business now. I'm not going to be surprised at anything going on anymore, anywhere, with how many hundreds of millions of dollars they're going to throw at anybody. Is what it is, and that's it. So it's
Devontae Adams. It's easy to say, oh well, you know. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, the guy's a draft. He's great. He's great for Rodgers.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's got to be more
yeah.
to this, you know, than money.
Yeah. Well, I still say there's something going on behind the scenes. We'll never find out about it. And, you know, the people that talk to me can give me every kind of – when Favre was retiring, you would not believe the stuff I heard about it. I mean, it was just comical after a while. And I just finally said to a couple guys there, I said, just listen, the guy wants to play. He made a poor decision. They're moving on to Rodgers. It's done, you know. And I really thought after the Jets he was just going to hang it up. But then to go to the Vikings, I mean, the ultimate insult. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Totally crazy. But whatever. We'll see what happens. Well, before I get something on, I want to spend a little time on our pregame discussion. And we're going to talk a little bit about football publications. The football publication market, to me, is a very interesting market. It's something I've heavily collected over the years. I'm good friends with two publication-only dealers back in the East Coast. And long story short, I find it interesting because we're moving to what amounts to being a paperless society, especially when it comes to sports, as a lot of game programs are no longer being published. Tickets are now electronically produced. Pocket schedules, as we talked to Judy Bartlett a few weeks ago, are rare now. Long story short, there's a lot less paper being generated as far as the game of any sport is concerned. So what I feel very strongly about, and we've had this discussion numerous times over the past 10 years, is that anything before World War II is always going to command a massive premium. My dealer friends agree with me. They say, you know, anytime they get a 1920s or a 1930s game program in, it's pretty much sold within a very short period of time. But what I'm not, I do understand and I don't understand is the classic sports runs of football. And I'm going to name Street and Smith from 1940 on. I'm going to name the classic football magazines of the 50s and 60s and 70s, Pro Sports, Dell Sports, the Sports Illustrated Sport Magazine, the Sporting News. Those are publications that are pretty much all gone today. I mean, you go to a newsstand, if you go find anywhere that actually sells magazines today, you're going to see a very, very limited amount of actual magazines. You're going to see more like the Beckett Price Guy magazine than you are going to see a regular sports magazine per se. So to me, those older football publications, and I'm going to go from World War II, 1945, right up to when everything started to be shut down as far as print is concerned, and that's starting in the early 2000s, we're seeing, to me, just a market waiting to be picked at and a market waiting to be collected. And what do I mean by that? All right, you're a Seahawk collector, for example. I'll use you as an example. Mm-hmm. You're a Seahawk collector, and you love your Seahawks, and you've been with them from day one. So you're going to try to acquire, in addition to your collection, all the different ones that have a Seahawk player on the front of them. For example, any Street and Smiths that had a Seahawk player on it, any sport magazine, Sporting News, and Sports Illustrated. You know, there's a lot of different regional magazines that possibly have Seahawk players on. You want to try to find and collect those for your collection. That's just collection number one, example number one. Other collectors, longtime, for example, New York Giant football fans, trying to collect everything from the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, and they basically stop in the early 70s. They also, the other New York type Giant collector collects everything from the 80s and 90s through the Eli Manning era, and they stop at that point. And again, there's not that going to be that much to collect right now, and we really haven't seen much to collect as far as that is concerned, especially with football media guides, as a lot of teams are now switching their media guides to electronic publication. It's interesting, the Packers are still producing their yearbook, and they're still producing their media guide. So that's a good sign, but I don't know of any NFL team, other NFL team, that's actually doing a yearbook anymore. At one time, most of the teams did it, and now it's few and far between trying to find them. So it's how the market and where the market is going, so on and so forth. I know I've done shows, and you've seen my table at several shows. I had a lot of publications, not just football, but other publications. And it was always hit or miss. Some shows some nationals I would go to, I basically would sell all my publications, and other shows I would not sell any. So it was pretty interesting to see, you know, what the market was doing, what everybody's looking at, and so on and so forth. So I've always said to collectors, if you reach the point in your collection where you're pretty much, you know, you're at a dead end, why not look at publications, you know? And again, you don't have to go, you know, if you're a New York Giant fan, you don't need to collect every media guy from 19, you know, from the 30s on type of thing. You could collect where you find them, so on and so forth. And what's scary to me is, in a way, is some publications are just being given away completely, and other publications are, you know, very much in demand, therefore they're always going to command a higher price. So it's interesting to see what's going on in the market as far as football publications are concerned. It's an overlooked part of our market, of our collectible market, and I really believe very strongly there's some really serious bargains out there for collectors to add to their collections. And I really think if you want to do something different, now's the time. Now's the time to make the move and look and collect whatever you're going to collect. I will say this, most in-demand publication for the teams in the NFL continue to be the Packers, the Cowboys,
yep,
the Bears, and the New York Giants. That's been my view of it for the past few years. The Brady era for the Patriots has also commanded a lot of collecting of Brady-related programs, so on and so forth. So that's something to look at the same time. So anyway.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is our guest here?
Go ahead.
It's like I was talking about before the show. Yeah. I collect concert tickets. I collect, you know, ticket stubs and programs from Red Grange's playing days. And that stuff's gone now. There's no ticket stubs. No concert tickets, no football tickets, no none of any sort. It's tough, right, for us people who love to collect those trinkets.
Yep. And, you know, again, it's the paper collectible that can add so much to a collection, the pocket schedule, the ticket stub, the media guide, the team yearbook, the team program, so on and so forth. And, again, I know I'm old school, but I always thought attending a game, no matter what sport it was, I would make sure I'd pick up a program, and I would always save my ticket stub.
Yep.
So, and, you know, I can see other people, and I remember years ago reading an article in the Sporting News back in the 1980s where a dealer was saying, this is back in the early days of collecting, the early 1980s, he says he sees more people going to a baseball game. He was using baseball as an example, going to a baseball game, and they would, at the end of the game, throw their program out. Forget about the ticket stub. That'd be a bad thing. And it's just amazing to see how much has been disposed of over the years that's never going to come back, number one, and it's never going to be able to be collected again. So it's a major problem as far as where we're going to see this part of the hobby going, if it's just going to be, an ending for that part of the hobby, which, to me, it's going to be one way or the other. If you're not going to produce any more paper ticket stubs, ticket stub collecting is going to be very, very limited in the future. And at the same time, the issue that we will always see with regard to, how does the next set of collectors come back to the market? That kind of thing. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the long run with that. So we'll see what happens. So I don't know. It's disappointing in a way for me because again, it's such a great part of the hobby that I think a lot of individuals really, in a way, don't realize it's there, so on and so forth, and they overlook it, and it becomes problematic, to say the least.
Yeah.
So,
I have framed ticket stubs from concerts I've been to that I just, hanged in my office. And I love it. It's such a good, memory. If I'm on calls, I'll walk over and look at them and remember all the stubs. I took my son Xander to his first concert of last week. It's a digital ticket. So what I did took a screenshot of the ticket and I printed it out in color, and that's his ticket. It's just, I don't know.
Wow. Unbelievable. But it is what it is, and that's it. All right, we're still waiting for our guest to log in here. So we got to get a few more minutes before you'll be here. So let's.
You're right about programs too, Bob. Because probably about 5-6 years ago, I was like, you know what? I want a program from every single game of the Seahawks inaugural season. Okay, so you find the schedule, you start looking on eBay, and I think I made it to 11 of them and no more. It's there's all these little tangents of things you can collect. Ticket stubs from every game. I mean, ticket stub from the first touchdown pass Largent caught. Ticket stub from the first seat. I do have from the first win the Seattle Seahawks ever had, which was against the lowly Tampa Bay Buccaneers that year.
Yeah,
I think
the
Seahawks started off in the NFC West. I think we played, before switching to the AFC West in 77.
Right.
And I think we played Tampa Bay twice that year. And that was – so I think Seattle went 2-12, 14-game season. Our only two wins were against the Buccaneers, and the Buccaneers went 0-14 that year, I think, both of us expansion teams. So,
again, that's a real neat collectible because realistically, how many of them survived, and again, it's a first game. It's amazing, how many actually survived out of how many, 50,000 tickets, a couple thousand at the most, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I could be completely off, or everybody just saved them type of thing. So it's interesting to see. I know a lot of collectors were collecting Favre's games with the Packers, and that's a tough collectible. And I know that a lot of guys started it with Rodgers also. But what did you do starting in the 2020 season, and when everything went to digital? So I don't know. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see what's going to happen. So in the long run.
Yeah. I don't know. It's tough. We've also brought up, I keep remembering this, but Carl, once mentioned, he's like, we don't think about paper drives,
right.
all these 20 tickets you just mentioned. It's like 50,000 people attend a Red Grange game. What percentage of people just throw the ticket on the ground? What percentage of people go home and it gets lost, that normally gets set on the kitchen counter and thrown away by your wife, like most things. And then it's got to survive paper drives. It's got to survive, some of the tickets I have are coming up on 100 years old. It's got to survive, being stuffed in an attic, flood, fire, tornado. I mean, all of it, insects eating it when it's stuffed away in the attic. I mean, accidentally throwing out all of it and to make it into our hands.
Yep.
I mean, out of the 50,000, how many of them are there? And it's such a cool little, facet of the hobby to collect. I don't know. I love collecting them. To me, I love looking up where the seat is in the stadium and then seeing where my ticket is from a 100-year-old game. And then, just kind of like, wow, those were good seats.
It's interesting because it's so historical. It's such a part of the collecting world. And again, it's going to be a little sad to see, what happens in the future, what direction it goes to, that kind of situation. Yeah, it's the same thing with cards. Again, not knowing what the new company is going to do, taking over Topps and taking over all the licenses, what are they going to produce? Digital cards? What are they going to produce? Just ones of ones or just produce cards? Could be really up in the air one way or the other with regards to what direction football cards are going. So I don't know. I don't understand the direction, the view of what's going to happen. With regards to it, and that's it. Well, you're listening to our podcast, Gridiron Greats. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com for all subscriptions. information. We're waiting for our guest. I sent a quick email out to him. Our guest is overseas, so I want to make sure we got all our T's crossed and I's dotted here. But this was the scheduling of the time, so this could be a Joe and Bob 2 minute
talk. For those
talk.
Listening, it is a military exercise for Bob to schedule this sometimes. I'm on the West Coast. I'm in Portland, Oregon. It's 7 a.m. here, 7:30 now. Bob's on the East Coast, 3 hours ahead of me, and we invited a guest from London, England, who's, you know, what, eight
four.
Hours ahead?
No.
Yeah, eight ahead of me.
No, actually.
Ahead of you.
Yeah, so he's four ahead,
so
of,
when,
ahead of me,
yeah.
eight hours from you. So we all agreed to the timing, so I honestly don't know what happened.
So when Bob sends an email out to coordinate this, there's been many times where it's like, you know, hey, Joe, can you do a, so I mean, poor Bob is, you know, like when he invites me, it's like, all right, it's 2 o'clock your time, 5 o'clock my time. And then if we have somebody in Texas,
yep.
it's 2 o'clock Joe's time, 4 o'clock their time, 5 o'clock my
yep.
time.
Yep.
I mean, it's almost comical sometimes where we just have to narrow that down. And this email chain was one of the funniest because you were scheduling this before daylight savings went in effect. And they don't have that, so you really had to go to work at this. It was almost fun
yeah.
to watch.
Well, he said daylight savings time is tonight for him. So then it would have been, we would have been 3 o'clock his time because you put the hour ahead. So I don't get it.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm at this stage of the game. It is what it is, and that's it. So this has only happened a couple of times in almost 10 years of doing this, so it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But anyway, shifting gears one more time, an update at the new home of Gridiron Greats Magazine here in Southport, North Carolina. I got a delivery during the week of two bookcases / drawed bookcases. So they're basically four shelves and they're basically four drawers underneath them. Oh, okay. I'm going to think we got somebody here. Hold on. Jane, is that you?
It is. I'm so sorry, guys.
Okay.
My internet picked a terrible time to completely fail on me. So I'm dialing over the internet from here in the UK, and everything kind of failed about half an hour ago, but I'm back up now.
Okay. All right. So we saved them.
Welcome to the show.
We're going to talk about my bookcases that just came in this past week for my office here. All right. I'd like to introduce you before we get started. Our special guest
sure.
tonight is a writer and editor based in London in the United Kingdom. He's been an NFL fan since the mid-1980s. He started Pigskin Books website in 2018 as a resource for fans of
yes.
football books. He also helps to run the United Kingdom Ravens Twitter account and is a regular on the United Kingdom's Raven podcast. I'd like to welcome to our show this morning, Mr. Shane Richmond. Shane, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yep.
And I'm going to lead off immediately by ask if you could tell our audience, Shane, how'd you start following United States football?
Sure. So in the 80s, we got a new TV channel here in the UK, which had a remit to show stuff that was different to what was available on other channels. And so in the early 80s, they started showing the NFL. And I started watching, I think, in the 85 season when I would have been 11 years old, and was just completely hooked. I'd never seen the game before, but, you know, the uniforms, the fact that players were wearing helmets, there were games that were played indoors, which soccer games here aren't. So there was all this amazing stuff going on in domes and all sorts. And it was fascinating to watch, even though I didn't understand the rules or anything. So I started getting books from the library to kind of teach myself the rules and watching every week, and became a fan from then, basically.
Wow. That's
What a great story.
It's actually cool.
Yeah, and it's quite common with a lot of British people my age got into the sport at around that time. And the stuff that was being shown on TV, it was kind of 6 p.m. our time, which is actually 1 p.m. on the East Coast, which is when the games kick off. But they didn't have live games then, so they would be showing us on Sunday at 6 p.m. the highlights of the previous week's games. So we were a week behind. Once you started to get into following a particular team, you had to wait until the results of that Sunday's game were in the newspaper on a Tuesday morning to find out whether your team had won or lost. Because obviously before the internet, there was no way to get instant updates on what was going on. So it was kind of weird being a fan back in those days. But it was for a good few years in the middle of the 80s, it was quite a popular sport here in the UK. And then it kind of sort of faded into the background a little bit.
That's funny. This is Joe, by the way. We're emailing back and forth.
Yeah,
the electrical company email. Right on. Thanks for being on the show. We appreciate it. But it's funny. Your story is, I mentioned I lived in London with an aunt when I was in high school, you know, for a while. And she got me into cricket in the same way. And I just remember fascinated by it. It's like, all right, well, how do you do this? A wicket? And then going to a park and playing with some people in the park and just, and for a long time following cricket. It was fun. But I wanted to move over your website, Pigskin Books. I've been perusing it for the last couple for the last week or so. Great website. It's just really well put together. I noticed one of the topics on there is the top five books for Cincinnati Bengals fans.
Yeah.
And I saw that there was the previous one was top five books for New Orleans Saints fans. I couldn't find the topic top five books for Seattle Seahawks fans. I'm a Seahawks fan. And then I got to thinking, are there five books on Seattle Seahawks?
That's a good question, actually. And I'm not sure. There are some of the teams that don't have a deep selection of books. The Panthers are another one. Obviously, they're a newer team than the Seahawks.
Yeah.
But there isn't one that comes to mind immediately about the Seahawks. I mean, every team has some biographies of big players, and so there'll be some of those around. And then when a team wins a Super Bowl, like the Seahawks did a few years ago, there are companies that will put out kind of the story of the year and that sort of stuff. But the kind of books where somebody sort of goes into the history of the team or spends a year with the team or that kind of stuff, there are a few teams that don't have a big catalog of those, and I think the Seahawks are one. I mean, my plan is, the website's been slightly dormant for a while because I haven't had time to add to it, but my plan is to have something on every single team by the end of it. But it's still at a point where there's a handful of teams where I don't have any Seahawks stuff at all.
Well, two of the five top books for the Bengals are about Paul Brown, so they're obviously living resting on their laurels there. But tell us about your website, how you got it started, and what the focus is.
Well, I started reading. I mean, like I say, when I was first into the sport in the 80s, one of the ways that I taught myself what was going on was by getting books out of the library and learning the rules that way.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of got used to reading about football from when I was first interested in it. But my wife is from Maryland, and when we started dating, I would go out there. We'd usually go out for Thanksgiving from about the year 2000. And one of the things I would always do is go to a bookshop and have a look at the American football books section, because bookstores here in the UK didn't have any NFL books or American football books. So I would come back with three or four each year. And it was always quite tricky to find out which ones I should be reading, you know, which ones were the ones that were really interesting, the ones that people talked about. And I would find a few little lists, you know, the kind of 10 football books you must read, that sort of thing. But there was nothing that kind of went deeper than that and gave you a bit of a guide to what the books were about, or allowed you to find books about a particular team or a particular era. And so in the end, once I got to a point where I had quite a few football books myself, I thought, well, I'll just start a website. I'll start the website that I would have liked to have had around when I started getting football books. And so that's been the aim of it.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Good.
How did, so I can probably answer this next question. How'd you become a fan of the Baltimore Ravens, then?
Yeah, so my wife's family are in Maryland. So the first Thanksgiving I went over there was 2000, and they asked if there was anything that I wanted to do while I was there. And I said, well, the one thing I'd really like to do is go to an NFL game, because I'd never been to an NFL game in the U.S. We actually had exhibition games here in the U.K. in the 80s. So I saw Dan Marino and Joe Montana play a preseason game at Wembley in London.
Yep.
But obviously preseason games haven't got the same kind of atmosphere and tension. And, you know, by the time you got to the fourth quarter, it was a bunch of guys playing that you've never heard of. So I wanted to go to a real regular season game. And my wife's family actually were all fans of Washington. They'd all been Washington fans like most of their lives. And they said, well, we'd normally be able to get you tickets because we'd know someone who's got spare tickets. But I think Washington were playing Dallas. It was either Dallas or Philly. It was a big divisional game, and nobody was giving up their tickets. So they said, there's no way we can get into that game. And I said, well, how far is Baltimore? Because Baltimore are playing at home. And they said, oh, yeah, we can get tickets for Baltimore. Baltimore are terrible. We'll get you tickets for that. So I went to see the Ravens take on the Browns. And it was the Ravens-Browns in the year 2000. So they had a season at that point where nobody thought they were going to do very much. They'd had a few games in the middle of the season where they didn't score an offensive touchdown. As I mentioned earlier, the first season that I got into the NFL was the 85 season, where the Chicago Bears ended up winning the Super Bowl. And I loved defensive football. I loved watching that 85 Bears defense and the fact that you just couldn't do anything about them. You just couldn't move, which I found astonishing. And I saw the same kind of defense playing for the Ravens in 2000. So the Browns, I think, scored a touchdown on their first drive. They went 70 yards or something to score a touchdown, took a 7-0 lead. They never gained another 70 yards in the rest of the game. The Ravens' defense just completely took over. And it was extraordinary. I was just, my jaw hit the floor watching it. This was 2000, so they didn't. This was 2000. This was the 2000 Ravens. So they didn't lose again. They went on and won the Super Bowl. Completely, addicted to the team after that. And I've been lucky enough. I spoke to Brian Billick, who for the website a while ago, and obviously he was the head coach at that game. And I said that was, I've kind of got you to thank for being a Ravens fan because it was that game that I went to. And he said, after that first drive, Ray Lewis came off the field and said to him, "Don't worry, coach, we got this. It's going to be fine." And he said, and he was just like, "Yeah, it was fine. They just completely took it over." So it was an incredible first game, and that was kind of what sold me as a Ravens fan.
You picked a hell of a game to go to.
Wow.
I loved it. That's awesome.
Yeah, and just complete
wow.
luck. I mean, it could have been, could have been anything. I could have ended up watching Washington, Dallas, or whatever, and picking one of those teams. But yeah.
Yeah, we've got too many Dallas Cowboys fans as it is. I'm glad you picked the Ravens. I'm curious, on your website, on the Ravens Twitter feed, "never over" is one of the, phrases that's in your backdrop. I've never heard of that associated with the Ravens. Where'd that come from?
So it started last season because they had so many ridiculous endings last season. There were so many games that came down to the final play or the last couple of minutes, and they didn't win all of them. In fact, quite a lot of them they lost, but they had started this slogan of "never over" that for the 2021 Ravens, they were never out of the game. So we were over in Maryland at Christmas, and I was lucky enough to go and see the Ravens take on the Packers. And going to that game, if you followed the Ravens last year, you'll know that they lost so many guys to injury. By the time they faced the Packers, Lamar Jackson wasn't there, so Tyler Huntley was playing at quarterback. There were a bunch of guys playing defensive back who I have never heard of. And I just was going to the game thinking, well, the Ravens are going to get destroyed by the Packers, but at least I'll get to see them. I haven't seen them for a couple of years because of the pandemic and stuff. At least I'll be at the game and it'll be fun. And as it was, the Ravens put on an incredible performance, and it came down again to the pretty much the final play. They went for a two-point conversion, which they didn't get, and lost the game by a point. And it was incredibly exciting. And to go into, they had so many games like that last season where you went into it thinking, there's no way they can do anything with this. They've got too many guys injured. And somehow they would take it right up to the wire, even if they didn't win. So that's where that never over thing came from.
Love it.
Wow.
It's funny how you become a fan of a certain team. You know, just like
it is
serendipitous, just like you did, you know, there with Baltimore. I mean, I'm in Oregon, you know, and you might not know where Oregon is. We're basically California's attic. And the closest team is the Seattle Seahawks. I mean, my parents just grew up watching it and I just became it, but it's always interesting how people became fans, but, I dig your website. You have to have some interesting stories about how, you know, content comes together, you know, just to be creative and keep that going.
It's been quite good fun as it starts to get noticed. So it doesn't have a massive audience, but it seems to be 1,000 visits or so a month. And it's become quite popular with certain other football writers or people who are really into football books and so on. So I had one instance a few years ago, for example, where somebody at an NFL team reached out to me and asked if I knew where they could find a copy of one of the books that I'd reviewed, which is it's a book called, what's it called? Franchise Makers, Salary Caps, and I can't actually remember the title of it now. I'm just looking for it behind me. Sleepers, Busts, and Franchise Makers, that's it. And it's a book that came out in the early 80s about the NFL draft. And this guy at the team reached out and said, do you know where you can get a copy, because I've asked Bill Polian, who's, you know, the former GM of the Colts and the Bills. I asked him if he had a copy and he didn't have a copy. He said, can you approach Cliff Crystal, who's one of the authors of the book and now works for the Packers? Uh-huh. He writes for their website. They got in touch with him. He wrote the book. He doesn't even have a copy. And they saw that I had a review on my website and said, do you know where I can get one? And I said, well, you can't have my copy because the copy I've got is the only one I've ever seen for sale. And it won't survive another reading. It's going to fall apart. excuse me. And in the end, I've kind of kept in touch with him, and we've got quite a good, because he's a book collector as well, and we've developed quite a good relationship. In the end, he found out that the GM of the team had a copy, so he borrowed the GM's copy, which he put in a scanner. So he scanned it to turn it into a PDF. And I said, weren't you worried that you were going to destroy this guy? This guy's the GM. You're going to destroy his book. End up getting fired because you ruined this football book, but apparently it survived. So that was kind of fun. There was another guy who got in touch because his dad was a coach in the 70s, and his dad has amassed this enormous book collection. He sent me all these photos of this book collection and said, you know, my dad is getting older now, and he wants to sell his book collection, and would you be interested in buying it? And I said, well, I don't really have the money to buy a massive book collection, and also I'm in London, so I have no idea how I can get it shipped. But it was fascinating to look through all these photos and see some of the books this guy had collected. So that's been one of the most fun things about it, is the people who get in touch who have this same passion for football books, because it's much more of a niche than baseball books.
Yep.
There's a big tradition of sort of literary baseball books that have come out over the years. But there are people who are really into football books, and they're just as dedicated. I think there's just fewer of them than for baseball.
Yep.
Yeah, there's definitely fewer collectors of football books than baseball books. And I have a reasonably large collection of football books, but again, there's so many books out there. You know, what do you collect after a while? You know, how do you keep up with everything? And my enjoyment has always been going to a thrift shop or an antique store and picking up books there, or, you know, like a tag sale or something like that, and seeing people getting rid of books. And in your case, you got to ship them to England. It's going to be difficult and very, very expensive. And it's tough. I feel for you.
It does add to the cost. I mean, I know somebody who we've got a copy of Bill Walsh's Finding the Winning Edge, which is one of the most expensive football books. There's only, I forget how many copies were printed, but Bill Walsh never allowed it to be reprinted. So you can pay $200 or $300 for a copy. And I know somebody who found one in a secondhand bookstore for $10. And it's just the most amazing find, because obviously whoever owned the bookshop just hadn't looked it up online to see how much it was really worth. So it's amazing what you can find in those kinds of sales.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I've picked up a lot of nice books over the years, and I continue to look for them, and it's very interesting to see and collect. Please tell our audience about your UK Ravens podcast that you do.
Sure. So we've been, you know, the Ravens are one of the newer franchises in the NFL, obviously, and like I say, a lot of British fans got into the NFL in the 80s. So there are fan groups over here that have been running since the 80s. The UK Buccaneers fan group, for example, goes back to the 80s. And the same with the Dolphins fan group. But the Ravens started, you know, in the early 2000s, and it's taken longer to kind of build up the following. They've never been one of the trendier teams. So we don't have the same kind of following that some of the big teams have. And a while ago, we started building up the following much more on Twitter, and there are guys on Facebook who've been building up a community there. And then about a year or so ago, a few of us decided, you know, actually it might be worth starting a podcast, just so that people can kind of follow along the season with us. And I wasn't sure, because I just thought, why are people going to listen to a handful of British guys talking about the Ravens when there are
the
Ravens podcasts from people who are in Baltimore? But it's actually
Bob
been,
and I think the same thing been, every show.
Yeah, I mean, it surprised me that, you know, we started it up and we get sort of 200, 250 people listening to each episode. We've had some really good guests on. We're lucky enough to have a very good relationship with the Ravens. So we've had a couple of people from the Ravens come on. We had Bradley Bozeman, the center, who was their Walter Payton Man of the Year. Unfortunately, just left the team yesterday to go to the Panthers, but we had him on last season. So we've had some good guests on, and people do seem to like it. And it's been really good fun doing it, actually. It's quite nice to spend a couple of hours one evening a week just chatting about football with your friends. It's, you know, it's good fun.
Yep. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I tell Bob, you know, I get the best seat in the house. I get to sit and talk football with a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's fun to be able to do that. And particularly, like I say, here in the UK, where it's still a minority sport. So I don't know anybody in my day-to-day life who's an NFL fan. And the other guys who I do the podcast with are spread all over the country. I mean, we've only met up in person once. So it's, you know, it's a good way of keeping in touch with fellow fans.
Okay, now I'm curious. I mean, do you watch football? Have you attended that many more games live? Like when the NFL is, you know, really trying to go over and, you know, play games at Wembley, you know, and, you know, in London. And, yeah, do you watch football? Like, is that something you turn on at 6 o'clock at night as you're winding down on a Sunday to just catch a game or anything like that?
Yeah. So I have Game Pass. We have a slight NFL Game Pass is slightly different in the UK to the US version, but NFL Game Pass here gives you every game live, so you can watch any of the games live or you can watch them back. So I watch all of the Ravens games live, and then I'll watch highlights of the other ones through the week. And the London games, yeah, I mean, I didn't go to the London games last season, but that was the first season I hadn't gone. So up until that point, I'd gone to all of them, so like 18 or 19 of them, I guess.
Wow.
Just because it's an opportunity to see football over here, which, you know, it's much harder, obviously, to see a game in the US because you've got to travel all that way. But, you know, when I go to the US, I always try and see games. So I've seen plenty of games at Baltimore, but I've gone to some Washington games. I've gone to some games in Jacksonville. I flew to Chicago once to see the Ravens play in Chicago. So I've been to quite a few games. And yeah, when I'm not able to get to a game, I'm always watching the games here live if I can.
That's really cool. Do you collect football items? Like, you know, Bob and I are avid football collectors, cards, programs, you know, ticket stubs, you know, et cetera. I mean, do you collect football?
I don't really. I've got some, I mean, other than, you know, I've got about 200 books or so on football. So the book collection is probably the thing. But I've got a couple of signed Ravens helmets that I've picked up over the years. I've got a football signed by Joe Flacco. I've got a couple of signed jerseys that I still need to get framed. I've got a Lamar Jackson signed jersey that I need to get in a frame and put on my office wall. So I've got some little bits and pieces of sort of collectible stuff, but I don't have anything specific that I collect.
Right on. That's right. Yeah, it's interesting to be. I guess that makes sense to be a fan and not, you know, collect. I mean, because for me, it just became a fan of the Seahawks, and then I was, mm-hmm. I was watching during the era of Steve Largent, became a Steve Largent fan, and next thing you know, you're looking for cards and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the cards, I'm always fascinated by the cards because we don't have them here. And then when I go to the States, I see them. And I've never really managed to figure out, there seem to be so many and such like a huge range of these cards that you can get.
Yeah.
But it's not something that's part of UK sporting culture particularly, so I've never really managed to get into it.
Yeah,
I'm just curious. Do they have soccer cards over there for all the like Manchester United? They don't really promote that kind of collectible.
What they tend to do is they have stickers. So when I was a kid, there were soccer stickers. So you would get a book, and the book has like a double page spread for each team, and there'll be a sticker for each of the starting players in the team, and then a sticker with the badge. And the idea is you collect them, and then you go into school and you swap the ones that you've got multiples of with somebody else who needs that particular one. So that was quite a big thing when I was a kid, but obviously because they're stickers and you stick them in the book, it's not one of those things that they don't have like a long life like the cards do particularly.
Okay. I forgot all about the stickers for soccer because I've seen those
like
over the years.
And talking to you mentioned cricket earlier, and they for a long time they had cigarette cards for cricketers. So if you bought a packet of cigarettes, I mean this is like back in the 30s and 40s. If you bought a packet of cigarettes, it would have like a painted picture of a cricket player and then a little biog on the back. So there are lots of people who are into cricket who collect these old cricket cards, the cigarette cards. But those obviously stopped a long time ago because they wanted to stop encouraging kids to smoke.
Yep, absolutely. Now, I'm curious. I mean, you have your wife is American, so probably, but do we talk funny? I mean, I'm always curious. Like, I have friends who live in Australia that we went and visited, for a month a couple of years ago. And, Bob talks funny. I mean, that's a given. But I guess more specifically, do I have an accent to you? Used to being right.
It's a recognizably American accent, but we're so used to, we have so much American TV over here, generally, drama and sitcoms and stuff. That, I mean, from the age of when we first start watching TV, we're exposed to American accents. And the same with, pop music and pop stars coming over and being interviewed and stuff. So I think it's probably the accent other than British accents. And British accents vary really widely. So actually American accents probably sound less unusual to me than some British accents do.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was there, some Irish ladies who lived next to us, I got a job at a bar called the Moosehead. Mm. Like, it was down by St. Peter's, Cathedral. I was back in London about 5 years and I went to find it. And it wasn't there, sadly. It was tough, but I began to be able to discern between them. Where I'm like, oh, that guy's an East Ender, it's kind of funny, but, when's the last time you came stateside to see a game? Or was so the last that, game you saw was the last game you saw in London?
No, the last game was at Christmas when we were over. So that was when I went to see the Packers play the Ravens. And that was it wasn't entirely weren't entirely sure that that was going to happen in the end, because we did obviously we did our COVID tests before we flew, and me, my wife, and my daughter were all negative, so we were clear to fly. And then the morning after we arrived, my daughter tested positive for COVID, so she had to isolate in her room. About 3 days later, my wife tested positive, so she had to isolate. At that point, the whole family, everyone was nervous that the next one would come down with COVID. So for a while, I was thinking, I don't even know if I'm going to make it to the game. If I end up testing positive, I'm going to be trapped at home as well. But actually, through the whole of the trip, I was negative the whole time. So I managed to get to Baltimore and see the game. So that was the last one that I went to.
Your Twitter page, your UK Ravens page, is really, it's fun. I scrolled through it yesterday
to
look at a lot of your old tweets.
I
think it's you and one other gentleman who do all
that's
the posting
right.
on that, correct? Okay.
Yeah.
Who's got the better sense of humor? Because there's some funny stuff up there that's...
Well, we complement each other quite well, I think. So Ian is much better at the kind of social media meme kind of references. He's much better at like his little gifs and those kind of jokes, whereas I'm much more sarcastic. So we sort of complement each other quite well with a slightly different sense of humor. And we have some followers who can guess which one of us is behind the tweet based on the kind of jerk that it is.
I'm just saying, my electric company's social media page, my marketing person is the fun, you know, touchy-feely, warm stuff. And I'm you know, hey, check this out. But I forget where it was. There's one of him in an airport bar where he's like, check this out. I forget what it was specifically, but really good. Really good. It's just, I just always enjoy someone who can, you know the touch of sense of humor plus the, informative posts. It's great. I really enjoy your website or your Twitter.
Yeah, no, we're quite pleased with how it's sort of, we're still slowly growing and adding people, which is great. So we're pleased with how it's gone.
And then how long have you guys been doing the podcast?
So the podcast is just a year old now. We just started in preseason last year, so that was our first year of doing it. So we've done about 32, 33 episodes, something like that. It's been pretty much once a week since August last year.
Okay.
Wow.
Interesting. I didn't get a chance to listen to any of them, but I noticed that's quite a few. That's a lot of content to produce.
It is, and it's. I mean, the good thing is that when you've got a game every week, it's quite easy to spend some time talking about the previous game, and then you start looking ahead to the next game, and so a lot of it, you're just reacting to stuff that has happened. And we tried to have a guest every week, and we pretty much managed that. So one of the things we were trying to do was get other UK fans on of the team that we were playing that week. So, the UK Bengals would come on, or the UK Rams or whoever, which gave us a chance to talk about how they became a fan of their particular team. Because it's always, you mentioned, it's always interesting how people become fans of a specific team, and it's especially interesting here in the UK because most people who are NFL fans don't have any ties to a particular place. There's some people here who have family in a part of America or whatever, but most people have picked a team for some reason. So we've had people who they were into Madden one particular year, so they picked a team that they used to play with on Madden all the time, or other people just sort of picked.
Played on Madden. That's funny. I love that. Sorry.
Yeah, so that's one of them. We have, like, amongst the UK Ravens, there's a few people who picked the Ravens because they were big fans of The Wire, the TV show. So they watched The Wire, which is set in Baltimore, and thought, okay, I'll support the Baltimore team. So it's like the stories people have for how they pick their teams are always fascinating. So we would get other UK fans to come on and talk to us, which is, it's been quite good fun.
Shane, we're almost out of time. We've got like 30 seconds left. I want to thank you for being on the show, and we've got to have you back out again for a regular segment. You got a lot of nice information from England about the game, and it's interesting to hear, believe me. It's something completely different. Thank you for being on.
Thanks for having me, guys. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Joe, Joe, 10 seconds, and we're done.
Great. Well, thanks,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah,
see you again soon.
Thank you, Shane.
Okay.
Yeah, I did a search for Seattle Seahawks books on the Pigskin Books website for Shane. It says zero. So.
Yeah. I'm going to have to try. I'll work on that for next time.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Shane.
That's all the time we got. We'll
thanks,
see you
guys.
Next week with another show. Bye.
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 Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network. Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.